I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In all the talk about gun regulations and school shooters, one aspect of the conversation that sometimes gets lost is how to make sure schools are as secure as possible right now, and how to prepare school staff and students so they know what to do in the event of a real emergency. When Governor Phil Scott announced some changes in his policy stance on gun legislation, he also included that school safety piece. He called for an immediate assessment of every single school in Vermont and the safety procedures and protocol these schools follow. And he said he wanted to find $5 million to go towards improving school security measures. Those assessments are underway right now, and today we're going to look at where they stand, at how well schools are doing on best practices, what those best practices are, and what kinds of changes our local schools might make on safety and security. Joining me now is Vermont State Police Lieutenant Matt Amidon, who's been doing some of those assessments, and Emily Harris, Vice Chair of the Vermont School Crisis Planning Team. She works for Vermont Emergency Management. Thank you both for joining me here today.
Thank you for having us.
All right, so as I said, this governor's action plan calls for the assessments to be completed by the end of March, with a report on his desk by the middle of next month. How far along are we? Are we well along in the process?
Anyway? We're well along. So one of the issues, as we know, is that some schools were on vacation at the beginning of this month, and then we've had some school closures due to weather. So there has been a little bit of a delay. But about a third of the assessments have already been completed. So I'm very comfortable with where we are right now. And I cannot imagine we won't have them completed by the end of the month.
And then the report goes to the governor by mid-April?
That's correct, yeah.
And what is that report? Just a compilation, or is it broken down by school?
So as it currently stands, it is going to be a compilation. I'm not sure exactly if he's going to want the final nitty-gritty details, but we'll see at that time.
Lieutenant Amidon, you've been going on some of these assessments. So what do you actually do? What do you do at a school assessment?
Yeah, initially we just reach out to the school. We reach out to maybe the point of contact, most likely the principal, just to go in there to start having the conversation on where they're at in the planning process. Most schools have a plan in place, and we go in there just to talk to them about that plan, you know, if they need any suggestions to it, what questions they have about the plan. But also we go in there with the with a kind of a survey. It'd take about 30 minutes to work through with the school on their plan, kind of looking at around three main facets of the assessment, you know, kind of looking to see what their individualized plan is, how developed it is, what the involvement is of the school, the communication with the students and the staff. Also looking at like the physical or the environmental aspects of the school, the needs, their strengths, and maybe where they want to take the school at the next step. And also looking forward, what do the schools need? We can talk about their needs on the physical side of things, you know, like the environmental changes they need to make to the school to make them maybe a little bit more safe. Or maybe it comes down to some training that they're looking for their staff or for, even for parents and for the students.
So there is a checklist, and yet there's also more sort of individual tailored approaches to the school security, depending on what the school is, what it looks like, who's in it, et cetera.
Yes, it varies greatly from school to school. There is no cookie cutter plan for every school. It would be nice if there was, but every school is different. From, you know, you have schools in a very urban area to schools in a very remote area. Their needs are vastly different.
Emily Harris, you helped to write up these school assessments, the checklist, the things that the people who go into the schools are supposed to be checking on. So how did you do that, given that each school is different?
So we ask broad questions about, are you locking your doors? Do you have visitor security access? And what that actually looks like in the individual school is going to be different. And that's the conversation that's key to be having with law enforcement to say, okay, if you're not locking all of your doors, why aren't you? Here's where the problems might be with your particular campus. campus and what you may want to do differently.
How do you address it differently, a rural school versus an urban school, for example?
Well, with the locking of the doors, I don't necessarily know that you would, because the best practice is that you're keeping your doors locked during the day and having one main entry and exit. But you may have to make some modifications in how you're doing your visitor pass system if you do not have additional staff that can be monitoring that door. Maybe you'll have to use video monitoring equipment or something like that.
So you mentioned that there are some specific things, like you should have a main entrance and exit that you're using throughout the day, and it should be locked. That's just standard protocol, one main entrance and exit, and it should always be locked?
That is definitely the best practice, yes.
And has every school you've gone to, Lieutenant Amidon, followed that practice?
So far, so good. You know, it's everybody's at a different place in their planning and where they're at with their physical security. But I think most schools are on board with controlling the entrance and exit point and having control of those who are in the building.
How many school assessments have you gone on?
I have gone on 4 so far. There are about 40 schools, both public, private, and independent within our patrol area.
We got a note from somebody who wants to mention one of those schools, and Michael says, good luck securing a school like St. Johnsbury Academy or Linden Institute, where the sidewalks flood with students between classes. So what is the protocol, or how do you think about campuses, schools that have more than one building, and you have all kinds of people, including students and faculty, going back and forth?
So really the goal is to mitigate the potential impacts. So we're not going to be able to secure everyone and keep everyone in a box at all times, but it's to look at where there are potential areas that we can improve, where our communications can improve. Do we have faculty outside that have radios that are monitoring what's going on and can request additional resources if needed? Those sorts of things.
So you would actually have people whose part of their job, maybe as a teacher, was in between classes to be out there with a radio?
Oh, yes. And I would say that there's a lot of schools that are doing that. So when buses are coming in, when recess is happening in various schools, they have staff outside that have radios where they can communicate back and forth within school.
What kinds of conversations do you have with school officials about these school assessments and what you're doing and what you're trying to do?
So I'll say for myself, no school has actually questioned this yet. Every school is just excited to have an opportunity to have law enforcement come into the school and talk to them about best practices. And in looking at the surveys, we see that this is not the first time that our law enforcement has been into schools this year. Everyone's reporting that they've already had first responders in to review their emergency operations plans, to do site visits, participate in school safety drills, also participating on school crisis planning teams. So law enforcement has been out there, and this is just another opportunity for them to go.
So from your perspective, Emily, it seems welcome, this idea of the state helping to run these assessments and then hoping to provide some money for upgrades and improvements.
Yes.
Is that what you've felt as well, Lieutenant Amidon, as you enter these schools, or is this sort of like, oh God, here they are to tell us what we're doing wrong kind of feeling?
I think it's very positive. I think the main goal, too, is just to keep that line of communication open. You know, we always jump to the worst case scenario that, you know, that we're talking about here today, but there's also, you know, some of those issues that kind of pop up where it's just a conversation piece between either law enforcement, the superintendent, the principal, that we can work out ahead of time. And by showing our faces and making those connections, a lot of times we can deal with issues way before they would even be to a point where we're kind of discussing today.
Have you had experiences like that? Do you have an example?
I've had some discussions with, principals, with students that have been, have started to show signs of being a little bit more aggressive or upset with the school. We had an issue at the Concord Elementary School. There wasn't a direct threat. It was something that was just reposted on Facebook. But the call came in. We got people out there. We identified where the post came from. It was from out of state. Had nothing to do with the Concord School. It actually had something to do with the Concord, New Hampshire school. And we were able to provide that information to the school to give them a sense of confidence that, you know, and release their anxiety for the day. And it's that kind of communication response that I think schools are looking for.
And that particular process, that threat assessment process, is something the school crisis planning team's been recommending for a while, that when you ever have a student of concern or even a faculty of concern or a parent of concern, you're coming together collaboratively discussing the situation, and maybe it's something where you're not even concerned about them for something they could do negatively to the school, but for themselves, and figuring out what the next steps are and making sure everyone with information is at the table and having those conversations together.
Well, we got a note from Pete in Moortown, who says, we do not need enhanced safety measures in Vermont schools. Research shows that violence at schools is almost universally committed by an insider who can gain access no matter the level of security. We need to put all our resources into four areas. One, robust school and community-based mental health services. Two, creating school climates that are emotionally safe for all students. Three, shifting school discipline practices towards a restorative justice model. And four, enacting laws that limit the number of guns in society. These will ensure safer schools and a safer general public. Very little gun violence actually takes place in schools, but school reforms can go a long way toward our societal problems with violence. Now, I want to point out as well that on Vermont Edition, we've been talking about some of those areas that Pete talks about. How do schools try to address resilience, address children and young people who are experiencing problems, maybe exhibiting violence, maybe exhibiting a little bit of an outsider status. And I'll make sure that we link to those shows. But Emily Harris, what about Pete's assessment? I mean, does it go in tandem with physical security measures and training protocol? Or do you agree with Pete that we don't need that? We need to put all of our eggs into these other baskets.
So the Vermont School Crisis Planning Team advocates for something called an all-hazard approach, where we're not focused on just one particular hazard that could happen. We're thinking about bus accidents. We're thinking about hazmat accidents. And we're thinking about things that, when we improve them now, will help us no matter what's going on. So, for example, a school's ability to communicate with parents. We know that that happens when schools closed for weather. We also know that they're going to need to do that if a hazmat incident happens or if there's an active shooter. Their ability to do that is something that should be planned, trained, and exercised so they're able to do it well the next time. Same thing with their ability to communicate internally. So there are these buckets of focus that are going to help you no matter what the situation is.
What about that question that Pete brings up of community-based mental health services and school climates that are emotionally safe for students? We know that the governor has asked for this $5 million to be released to help with school safety and security. But what about funneling that money into more resource officers or more crisis counselors for schools?
So because we've only completed a third of the surveys, I hesitate to say where it is we're going to need to direct that money and resources to. So once those surveys are completed, we're going to be able to make recommendations to the governor as to where we see as areas for improvement.
But that's a possibility, that it might not be physical security protocols. It might be more school resources.
I don't know what the governor is going to choose to use resources on, but outside of the money question, we have resources in state. So myself, part of my position is helping schools with their planning and training. And we also have a school safety liaison officer who does go out into schools and do school assessments on a regular basis. It's something that when they call up, he goes and does these assessments. And so we may find that, some schools are saying that they need additional training on de-escalation and violence prevention. Maybe we need another training video, or maybe we need to bring in outside trainers. Maybe we need to create additional planning documents. So we ourselves throughout the years have been creating these other things, even if money doesn't become available.
Lieutenant Amidon, as you go through these assessments that you've been on and that your colleagues have been on, do you have a sense yet of generally where Vermont schools might need to work on improvement? Is it training? Is it protocol? Is it the physical space? All three? You know, something different?
It varies. Some schools I've gone to are well established in their plan, well established in their training. The communication between the principal and faculty is great. Communication with the parents is very open and great. And other schools aren't quite at that point, but they're developing. So it does vary. And when it comes down to, you know, where are their strengths and where are their needs for improvement, it varies. It varies too from school to school. And it depends on where they want to be too. There's no one specific direction or point that we can point a finger to. It just like I said, it's just very varied.
So one of the things I'll say is I've heard from a lot of schools that they haven't made those connections yet with parents about what they can expect before, during, and after an event. And so that's an area that we've been encouraging schools in. There's actually some documentation on our School Safety Center website, which can I plug now? Is that
sure,
okay?
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
So it's schoolsafety.vermont, all spelled out, .gov. And that website has a bunch of planning, training, and exercise documentation. It also has a suggested guide for parents and guardians about what to do and what not to do during an emergency. And some of the things that it actually recommends is that before an emergency happens, make sure that your school has current, accurate contact information. So if you never are at home and they only have your home phone number, they will not be able to reach you during the day. So make sure that you have a method for them to communicate with you. During an event, make sure that you aren't going to the school. Because there is an incident occurring, you will be harming the response by getting in the way, creating traffic jams, and you won't get information any faster doing that. Also, especially when it comes to active shooter situations, don't call your child. If your child has a cell phone, that could put them in harm's way if the cell phone goes off and they're in a lockdown situation where they need to be quiet. So don't call your child. And so those are some things that parents can be doing when something happens. And it's really important because it's very scary when something is happening at a school where your child is, and you need to know what you can do to help the situation.
Emily Harris is vice chair of the Vermont School Crisis Planning Team. She works for Vermont Emergency Management. Matt Amadon is a Vermont State Police Lieutenant. They are with us today going over how Vermont schools think about school safety and security in emergency situations, like someone with a gun or other threats on campus. Emily Harris mentioned the Vermont School Safety Center website, and we have linked to that at vpr.net if you click on Vermont Edition so you can see some of the things that she was talking about. We got a note from Heather who says, as a special needs parent, there are even added concerns. Our Rutland Autism Family Group was just discussing how to keep our kids safe in situations like these, especially those who tend to make loud noises as a way to comfort themselves, or are nonverbal, or have a hard time following complex instructions. I know some schools in our area are starting to have conversations about ensuring our kids' safety, too. Emily Harris, how do schools and how should they be approaching situations like this? And whether it's schools where there are students with special needs or schools with very young students who may not be able to follow instructions or even kids with mobility issues who may not be able to get quickly to a location where somebody wants them to get to.
So starting with the special needs students, the recommendation that's coming out from the federal level is to look at the individual education plans and in that document spell out what might be unique for this particular student and come up with your game plan, knowing that that may vary throughout the day and that you want to be holding your emergency drills at different times of day and different days of the week so you're able to identify where those issues might be. As far as mobility issues, it's the same sort of thing. Figuring out if you need specific chairs that are going to go downstairs if the elevator is out of order for a variety of reasons. And what was the final question? I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, or very young children who can't follow instructions, but similarly, you know, yeah. Sounds like children who might need some help following instructions.
Mm-hmm. And so there's something that's recommended by the School Crisis Planning Team, which is called the Standard Response Protocol. It's four actions. It's lockout, lockdown, shelter, and evacuate. And one of the things that's wonderful about this program is it actually provides training to schools as to how to present this information depending on the age group that you're presenting it to. So you might want to, during a lockdown situation, I believe they call it the bunny yoga pose, where you get very young children to hide their head down and peek out, but be very quiet. And so there are different ways to talk to different age groups, and they spell that out through the Standard Response Protocol.
Sometimes when you hear about situations where there's been an emergency within a building and there are these different stages, and sometimes it's shelter in place and sometimes it's evacuate as quickly as possible. And Lieutenant Amadon, we hear in some of these situations where teachers have said to students, run, just run, go. Is that actually best practice in some cases to just go? Because, I mean, you can imagine all these kids scattering, and then it's scary and difficult to round them up again and find them when the all clear has come.
Yeah, it's a difficult situation to deal with, but it is an option. Outside, over the last 20 or so years, the philosophy has been to lock the doors and shelter in place. But now, you know, teachers and faculty have looked for options outside of that. They don't want to be, I hate to say it, quote unquote, sitting ducks. So we're looking to guide teachers to give them options, you know, get away from the threat, run, find a place in the school, whether it's in your classroom, hide, you know, do that shelter in place, lock the doors, make sure the security is in place, cover the windows. But outside of that, if the threat is still active and you need to get further away from the school, then that is an option. That's something the teacher can say, yes, this is an option for me, my students, it's best for the group, let's do it. And after that, the last option is to fight. You know, don't just sit there and wait for that threat to come to you. You have the option now to be active, take care of it, you know, do what's best for you, your classroom, your students, your school. You know, we want that option on the table.
Since 2015, the Agency of Education, Department of Public Safety, has recommended to schools that they promote an options-based approach to an active shooter, and that's exactly what the lieutenant's talking about, where your first option is to get away or run. Your next option is to hide.
If you can't do the getaway or run.
If you can't do the getaway, and then your final option is potentially to fight. And that's a life safety decision that you're going to have to make in the moment based on your situational awareness of what is going on. And I'd recommend to all of your listeners, there's a 6-minute video through the Department of Homeland Security called Run, Hide, Fight. If you Google search it, I believe it's the first hit that comes up. And it just takes you through 6 minutes of what this options-based approach is and what it is that's being promoted through schools.
Now, I know, Emily, you mentioned that that the state takes an all-hazards approach and that there are lots of different things that can happen, some of them very scary and some of them less scary. Sometimes it's a water main leak, and so suddenly the school has to be evacuated. But because people are really focused on this active shooter situation and because that's so scary for people to contemplate, while acknowledging that it's actually very rare, let's talk about a few more things that are best practice that I think people sometimes think about and schools have to figure out. If there is a threatening individual with a gun in the building, should you pull the fire alarm to get everybody out of the building?
No. So you would use the information that you have available if you have an overhead system to let people know what's going on.
Like a PA system?
Yeah, if you have a PA system, you can actually announce through the PA system, individual with a gun, in the lobby. So you're providing your staff and students with that situational awareness so they know if they can get out another way. Yes.
Okay, so don't pull the fire alarm because that sends everybody flooding into
the
halls.
Fire alarms are for fires.
One of the other questions that comes up as well is, you know, these are drills. They're practice drills. People want to know what they should do, and it's good to practice so you know where the exits are. You know where the doors are. You know how to gather your classroom. You know how long it might take. But there could be this idea that you should do that and not tell people it's a drill because you want them to be right in line with what they think they would do in an actual emergency. However, that could be very scary for people. Additionally, you know, if you have enough drills, people may be sliding on the cell phone use, et cetera. So what's the best practice? Call it a drill and say, this is a drill we're practicing?
Yes.
Or don't say it?
Yes. You say that it's a drill. We don't want people to be harmed during a drill, which is what will happen if they think it's a real event. You will have people maybe jumping out of windows. We don't want to have that happen if it's only a drill. So yes, notify people that it is a drill. And one of the best practices that can avoid people slipping is have a hot wash after the drill. And that hot wash is where you have a conversation with your staff and students and say, what went really well? What didn't go well? Where are we going to improve so we do better the next time? And holding folks accountable for making sure that we're making those progress in those areas. Because if we're not making progress, having the drill doesn't really help us a whole lot.
Lieutenant Amidon, you mentioned that the schools you've been to so far are doing well on that idea of a locked door policy, but that's only as good as, you know, one student in drama class leaving a shoe in the door because they need to run out real quickly and grab something. I mean, how should schools be, without scaring their students, making sure that everybody, faculty, students, staff, are all on board with these protocols? Because, you know, there are a lot of doors that should be locked and maybe are locked when people know that the state police are coming for an assessment, but maybe aren't locked every afternoon.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's situational awareness for the school, for the faculty, and for the staff. We had the conversation at one of the schools because summer months are coming up, and what do the classrooms want to do? It gets hot. They want to prop open all the doors. We totally understand that. But you've got to look at the big picture. on why the doors are closed and why there are security measures in place. And just people just have to keep each other accountable and be aware.
You know, we're talking about these assessments and we talk about how the schools need to put them in place. But Emily, I'm curious about not only that communication with parents, but the communication with students, because you know, students need to know what they're supposed to do and why and how, and not only have somebody telling them this is what to do, but be able to have that line of communication open so they can share their thoughts about, this was really scary, or I don't think this worked, or, you know, this is not going well for my classroom, or why are we doing this? Do schools have that line of communication?
Yes, and so, again, cautioning that we've only seen about 30% of the surveys come in yet, a lot of the surveys we're seeing are saying that, yes, we are training faculty, staff, and students in what our stand response procedures are, why those are. A best practice is, as the year begins, as the semester begins, bring everyone together for an assembly and let folks know. We also recommend that you post posters up of what all of these different protocols are, so you're not having to go through your memory bank and say, okay, what is the difference between a lockout and a lockdown? I don't remember. And having a poster is really helpful for that.
And do you talk to students? I mean, do you go around the faculty and around the administrators ever to talk to students about what they believe they know is going right or wrong?
Nope. I'll tell you, I have not actually done that.
Lieutenant Amidon, do you ever, you know, not sort of pull a student aside and say, so really, how's this going?
No, I've never talked to like a student that direct. We have attended, drills at schools, and afterwards we've had faculty meetings. And then you can have that little bit more blunt conversation with the faculty and staff on where they're at and answer the questions that they feel they need addressed.
I mean, I'd be curious to know how students would assess these assessments and assess their training, because, of course, you know, if you have one teacher who needs to do all of these things and 20 students or 30 students, they need to know what's going on, too. And I'd be curious, students, if you are listening, or parents, if you want to ask your students and let us know, you know, what do they feel like they know? Do they feel like they have enough information? Is this going well? Lieutenant Amidon, you mentioned that, and both you and Emily Harris have mentioned that it's really different depending on the situation. And again, we're not talking only about situations where somebody with a gun is in school. We're talking about all kinds of hazards and this individual approach to it matters what the situation is, it matters what your building looks like, it matters who you are, what your class is, what the conditions of your students are. But holy smokes, that's a lot of responsibility. I mean, we did an active shooter drill at VPR, and it was scary to think about, okay, these are the things I need to think about to keep myself safe. But if I was then also supposed to keep 27 students safe, and I'm charged with making that decision, there's no checklist, there's a guideline depending on what the situation is, that's a lot of responsibility, and that just seems very difficult. I guess there's no real question here, but an acknowledgement that that's a heavy load.
It is, and I think that's actually part of the reason why for years we just said go into a lockdown. That was the standard approach, but we've seen a lot of studies come out that say, no, going into a lockdown and being a sitting duck is problematic, and that you do need to be so empowered to make those life safety decisions. You know, we always teach in a fire, the best place to be is not in the building, so it should be no different. If you are hearing that gunshots are coming from down the hall and you have the ability to get out of the building, to leave rather than leave yourself in harm's way.
So really, I mean, even though that makes it less of a sense of I know exactly what I'm going to do, it is best practice to just say trust your gut, trust your judgment.
Yes, that is the best practice that's been coming out from the federal government for a while now.
So how do you then train people to trust their guts or to know what their guts are even saying in a situation like that and not just freeze in fear, Lieutenant?
It is very difficult because, you know, in stressful situations like that, you know, a lot of people either go into the fight or flight mode. And part of getting over that, you have to train for it. And I talk to faculty and staff about what to do, I tell them that you have to think about these type of things ahead of time. You've got to put yourself in that situation in your mind and say, what would I do in these situations? And I think thinking through the processes, and I go back to like my military training, you talk about the 5 P's, prior planning prevents poor performance. You've got to think ahead before the actual event. If the event is going on and, you know, you've never thought about it, you know, the end results aren't going to be good. But you think ahead and plan for it, and you'll have a plan in place, and your rote memory will take over and make you, you know, come to the best solution, I guess, for you.
just to, again, echo some resources available on the School Safety Center website, we have this thing called What If Wednesdays, which is every few weeks on a Wednesday. It's a one question. It gives you a scenario, and you walk through and just pick a bullet and say, these are the things I would do in the situation. And it just helps you to put your mind there and say, okay, here's the situation. I have a boiler room where there is smoke pouring out and kids are coughing. What am I doing right now? So there are those scenarios available online. There's also something under our exercise tab, which they're video exercises walking schools and teachers through, here's the scenario, who are doing these particular things? Who is it that's notifying parents? Who is it that's organizing students? Who's doing accountability for the students that are out in the parking lot? Okay, if it's a 30-degree day and you're told you can't get back in the building, who makes the decision that you're going somewhere else? Where is that? So talking through these scenarios prior to them happening is so important.
We got a note from Jonathan in Berlin Corners who says, arm the teachers. Do either of you take a position on that?
That is not within the scope of my position.
Yeah, that's a conversation that's going on nationally. It's a conversation for the governor, the secretary of education, and the commissioner of public safety.
We got a note from Carter who says, what about arming teachers and students with strobe flashlights instead of guns? A shooter can't shoot what he can't see. How about more exits, a ladder out the window or to the roof for rooms not on the first floor? The hallway escape seems like a bad, if the only, option. So what about Carter's suggestions?
It's one of those things. Part of this assessment is looking at the physical assets of a building. And, you know, as we walk through, we can only deal with what we have. You know, we can't build all new schools to meet our needs at this point. So, you know, there are options out there to make the physical assets as safe as possible, and we can provide those suggestions and work through it with teachers and the staff.
And again, if we're going to be spending money on things, we should be thinking about those things that are most likely to be happening. So we should be spending money on training teachers and what these standard response protocols mean, making sure that folks know where their evacuation points are, because that's going to be useful regardless of the situation.
So Emily Harris, as I mentioned at the beginning, Governor Scott had said he'd like to have $5 million released, and it would be over more than a year to help with school safety and security. And part of your job is to make a recommendation to the governor. But do you have a sense that $5 million is actually forthcoming, that it will be found and released and that schools can count on that?
I've received no information about that particular funding source. However, we, as the school crisis planning team, are available to assist providing support if schools just want to call us up and have a conversation about their plans. Rob Evans, our school safety liaison officer, and myself do drive out to supervisor unions and help them with their plans and training.
All right. Well, this is obviously an ongoing situation, ongoing conversation, and we look forward to hearing more about the results of the school assessments, which are happening right now around the state. Emily Harris is vice chair of the Vermont School Crisis Planning Team. She works for Vermont Emergency Management. Matt Amadon is a Vermont State Police Lieutenant. Thanks very much to both of you for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.